Project Looking Glass, just what the heck is it? In a moment, Dr. Michael Sala joins us. That's just one of the topics we'll be talking with him about on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with you with Dr. Michael Sala, author of several books, of course, including U.S. Air Force Secret Space Program. Dr. Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics, author of Exposing U.S. Government Policies on Extraterrestrial Life, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence as well. Dr. Sala was an assistant professor in residence in the School of International Service at the American University. He's got a PhD in government from the University of Queensland in Australia. Also the founder of the Exopolitics Institute, which is a not-for-profit organization that analyzes the political implications of extraterrestrial life. Michael, welcome to the program. Great to have you on.
Thanks, Joe. It's great to be back.
Looking forward to this, and gosh, everybody's been talking about you. Last week, we've had guests on, Stephen Quayle, and they just all love your work, Michael.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. There's a lot happening, so I'm really thankful that I can write about this and get it out.
Exactly. A little bit includes, of course, Project Looking Glass, which I want to get into with you, but would you first tell everybody, because some people have heard this name, other people have not, QAnon, A-N-O-N, who is that? What is that?
Well, that is someone that began posting on the 4chan forum back in October of 2017. And very quickly, people suspected that this was actually a poster connected with military intelligence that was working alongside the Trump administration to put out a lot of information. And over the subsequent 2 years, it's been 2 years now, people are convinced, and that includes me, that this is indeed a group working closely with the Trump administration to put out information to really help expose what many people describe as the deep state and the kind of corruption and the shenanigans that goes on in terms of how different presidential administrations are controlled by this deep state.
And Q popped on and popped off. He seems to be back again, or the group seems to be back again. They're not very regular, are they?
Well, there was just a period of over a couple of months, just very shortly, that was ended. So from around, I think it was around September through to November, Q basically went dark. And there have been other periods where Q has gone dark for 10 days, short periods, but this was the longest period that Q went dark. And so people were wondering what all that was about.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to be that many believe that there was a kind of strategic reason behind that in terms of getting information or getting things done behind the scenes that would basically upend the deep state's plans to really subvert and to move forward with a coup against the Trump administration.
Interesting. Now, whoever it is or whatever it is, they're in the know. Somehow they're getting information. I'm just wondering if they work within government. Well, they definitely have contacts within government, don't they?
Oh, they are definitely deeply associated with the highest levels of military intelligence. One of the things that really got my attention back in January of 2018 was when 6 days before the false missile alert here that hit Hawaii, 6 days before that, QAnon was actually posting about a false flag nuclear event. And that really was spot on. And there have been other posts that Q has made that have turned out. And so people believe when you add all this up, it's very clearly someone that's in the know. And even Trump himself may be involved. Many people suspect that when Q signs off as Q Plus, that in fact is Donald Trump.
That's what I've heard. I've heard that too. What do you think of those possibilities?
It's very possible, especially when you look at the synchronicity between the Q posts and Donald Trump tweets. Often they're they're only like a minute apart, or sometimes even seconds apart, and that's a pretty difficult thing to do. And so many believe that that's just one sign that Q is working very closely with the Trump administration, and when QAnon signs off with that Q plus, that it's Trump himself.
Interesting, interesting. Will we ever find out, Michael?
Not sure, because I think Q really is all about starting up a mass movement. I mean, that's really what's happening now. We are talking about hundreds of thousands of people, probably millions of people around the world. It's not just in the United States. I mean, you get people in Holland, Scandinavia, you get Hong Kong and India. You get people all over the world coming out with Q shirts, making signs referring to Q. So it really is a worldwide movement, because a lot of people identify with this struggle against the deep state. They recognize that this is not just a U.S. problem, that it's a global problem. And so many people are supportive of what Q is doing. And we are talking about a mass movement now. And every day people look to the different posting boards to see what Q has put out most recently. But I think what has happened over the 2 years that Q has been posting is a lot of people have been able to develop really good analytical skills for understanding what's happening with the mainstream media, what the different political groups are doing in Congress. And so, you know, I think Q has succeeded in really awakening a mass movement and getting people to make, you know, ask the right questions, to look in the right places. And so I think at the end of the day, Q will just kind of like vanish, as all good intelligence operatives do.
Well, with Dr. Michael Sala, of course, Michael, we have a quick breaking story in Iran. 200 protesters who are protesting the high price of gasoline there just been shot to death by government troops. Unbelievable.
Yes, that's a sad story. That's terrible.
Q talked about Project Looking Glass. What is Project Looking Glass?
Well, the first reference, public reference to Project Looking Glass was from Bob Lazar in 1989. In some of the interviews he did, he started to talk about Project Looking Glass as one of the projects that was being, that he was briefed on, that he had these briefing papers given to him, and he identified four distinct projects. So he was working on one of them. One of them had to do with reverse engineering extraterrestrial propulsion technologies, but he referred to another project that was called Project Looking Glass that was focused on basically being able to distort time to be able to look into the past or into the future. And so he just read the briefing packet, and of course he basically related this to some extraterrestrial technology. But we know from subsequent people who have come forward that this is technology that has been used, that has been applied. One of the most famous examples of this was the Montauk project.
Mm-hmm.
That ran from 1971 to 1983 at Montauk Air Station on Long Island. And basically there was a chair, a very special chair, that was actually supplied by extraterrestrials, or at the very least taken out of an extraterrestrial craft. And what it would do, it would magnify or focus the consciousness of the person sitting in that chair. And so when you had someone who was psychic sitting in that chair, and they were tasked to, say, look into the future, then as that psychic was looking into the future, this chair would magnify that ability, and all of a sudden a portal would open up in the kind of radar dish that they had there that was part of the experiment. And it would open up, and you could look into that, and you could see future events. And it wasn't just a matter of looking into the future. You could also step through that time portal. And this is one of the things that actually was described from people who survived the Montauk Project, who went through it. They said that children were used, that there were many children basically that were sent through these time portals to test the technology, to see what it could do and to check its safety. And unfortunately, not all the children came back. So it was something that was very abusive, but nevertheless, it was developing this incredible technology to be able to look into the past or the future and to be able to travel there, which then raises the possibility, what happens if you travel into the past and change events? And that is exactly the kind of thing that was going on.
Michael, amazing work that you've been doing in George Van Tassel during the early 50s, of course, claimed that he was picked up, went to Venus with UFOs, extraterrestrials. What the research have you done into this individual?
Well, he's an amazing person. I mean, people know a little bit about him in terms of organizing the giant rock conventions, which I think even to this day are probably the biggest UFO conventions ever. I mean, they had like 13,000 people showing up at these conventions in Giant Rock at the desert, Mojave Desert there. And he was a contactee. He was someone that would often send messages and communicate on behalf of the extraterrestrials that were contacting him with the military. And so he was communicating with different branches of the military. And he was, in the 1960s, he gave an interview where he basically identified a Navy project doing this kind of Project Looking Glass development, this project that they were manipulating time, distorting it to be able to look into the past. And he said that this was technology that was given to the Navy by extraterrestrials. So he was someone that I think is very credible. Someone that did have a background in the aviation industry, running an airport for a while there. And so he was, someone who had a lot of information to share. And, he was saying that by the 1960s that the U.S. Navy was indeed working on this Project Looking Glass technology.
Interesting. Did he develop the Integratron?
That's the same one, yes.
Yeah.
He was given that information, again, by extraterrestrials, and that was something to generate the right kind of electromagnetic field to purify people's auric bodies and their different subtle bodies to prolong life. I mean, he thought that this was something, if it was completed, could actually lead to people living a lot longer because the extraterrestrials he was working with could live as long as 1,000 years, and now genetics apparently has that capacity to live for many centuries. And so he believed that the Integron would be a step towards that, and he never unfortunately completed it. I think he died in the early 70s before its completion. Some actually say that he was murdered because he was ready to complete it, and this was something that the deep state wouldn't allow, that they don't want humanity to be able to live past 100 with the quality of life where people could basically accumulate knowledge and be more effective in changing our world.
Yeah, died in 1978. What did people think of him?
Well, he was a very controversial figure because, unfortunately, in the UFO community, as you probably discovered, there's this great divide between those that just want to look at UFOs and do kind of scientific studies in terms of the sightings of UFOs, and then there are those that want to work with people who have had direct encounters with the extraterrestrials from the craft. And so Van Tassel, because he was someone that was actually interacting with the occupants of these flying saucer craft, he was targeted by many groups, including many UFO researchers that really wanted to kind of like ridicule him and others like him saying that there were these benevolent space brothers who were trying to help humanity evolve, develop a higher ethical consciousness and spirituality so that we would be one day ready to use and incorporate into our society the advanced technologies that the extraterrestrials were sharing. So unfortunately, he was one of those people that was widely ridiculed during his time. But I think the military intelligence community took him very seriously, as they did all of the contactees, because they knew these people were having contacts and that human-looking extraterrestrials were passing on important information about how to change our world. But people like Van Tassel were targeted and ridiculed.
You've been doing this, Michael, for how many years now? Have you ever been targeted?
Well, 2001 was when I began, and in terms of me being targeted, there was basically the time when I was associated with American University.
And I remember you and I talking on the air about that, and something happened, right?
That's right, yes. I was targeted because I started to get, after a major story by the Washington Post on my research on President Eisenhower meeting with extraterrestrials at Edwards Air Force Base in 1954, I was told straight out by the university that research was no longer welcome.
Jeez.
At the university, and they basically would not renew my appointment and canceled the program that I was trying to set up at the time.
Unbelievable. You think they would have opened you and welcomed you with open arms?
Well, that's what I thought. I mean, I thought that universities are places of innovation where new ideas are introduced and debated, and especially when you're looking at this kind of evidence that there's a high-level cover-up of the truth behind UFOs, that these have life-changing technologies, and you can't get anything more revolutionary than extraterrestrial visitors coming to our world with life-changing philosophies and technologies, but yet, rather than looking at that information impartially, I was targeted and removed from the university.
That's sad. Michael, you just mentioned Montauk, and of course, they were working on the development of portal technology. David Politis was just on before you talking about missing people who some could be stumbling into portals. Is it conceivable that project continued?
I think that that has been the modus operandi for a lot of these black programs, that people are just taken, whether from the streets or whether from national parks, but taken in a way where their disappearance isn't going to, create too much of a disturbance in the public arena. As David Politis, I'm sure, made clear that, when people disappear at national parks, this is something that happens quite often. And so there's not the same kind of public scrutiny as, say, people being taken from their home all of a sudden. So this is something that I think is the way in which these black projects operate, just taking people from places where they're not going to be missed, or where they can then be used to test the feasibility of these programs, or their skills put to use in these programs. And some of these programs are very dangerous. I mean, set
oh yeah,
people
absolutely
through portals.
Absolutely, and they may never come back.
Well, apparently that's what happened in the case of many of these children. Some of the estimates were several thousand children were sent through these time portals at Montauk and never came back.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Michael, and so many other things. Dr. Michael Sala with us, his website, exopolitics.org. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Dr. Michael Sala. We'll take calls with Michael next hour here on Coast to Coast. Michael, back to the Montauk Project, if we can, for a bit. These several thousand children, you said, that simply vanished and disappeared. Over what period of time was that?
That was from 1971 to 1983, and according to some of the survivors, we're talking a lot of street kids, kids that were homeless, and they were just taken into these projects and experimented on. And there was a lot of trauma-based mind control used on them as well. That seemed to be one of the ways in which they thought that these experiments could be more successful. And the children seemed to be more likely to be able to survive these kinds of portal experiments.
Do you think this project, Montauk, is still continuing?
Well, I think the Montauk project was set up to test the feasibility of these projects, especially time travel as a means of being able to, you know, not only look into the past or into the future, but also to be able to send people through those portals to then be able to manipulate time. And after that, we're talking about programs that became operational, and now you're not sending children through those portals. Now you're sending adults, you're sending soldiers, you're sending agents, you're sending people who go there with specific missions, which might include changing events in the past. So, you know, we're talking about temporal agents. I mean, that's, I think, the way in which you can best understand or describe a person who's sent through a time portal into another time, past, or future to change events.
Who is and was Father Pellegrino Ernetti?
Well, he was a priest that was studying the chanting of Benedictine monks using electronic methods to manipulate their chants. And so he wanted to measure how that would impact humans and how that could maybe have a greater effect on people emotionally. But what he found in testing the chanting and manipulating it electronically, and this was done by accident, there was a monitor that was used in those early experiments that were conducted by him at the Vatican, that he was able to see events in the past. And as they began to experiment more in terms of manipulating the vibrations, because we're talking about sound, and with the Benedictine monks, the chanting, that deep melodious sound that they generate, that actually has an effect in terms of warping space-time, distorting time. This is one of the things that the Looking Glass technology was also achieving, but Father Pellegrino found that he could do it electronically by manipulating these Benedictine chants, and that was
interesting.
That was then handed off to the CIA.
Now, this chronovisor that he kind of came up with and invented, is it still being used?
Definitely, yes. That is something that was developed. The initial prototypes were developed by him in the Vatican, and then he handed it off to the CIA because the Vatican and the CIA have worked together very closely for many years. Many people aren't aware that the chief of the CIA counterintelligence, James Jesus Angleton, from mid-1950s right up until 1975, he handled the Vatican desk as well as being in charge of the CIA counterintelligence. And so you have to ask yourself, well, why did the CIA work with the Vatican at that level in terms of counterintelligence? It was because the Vatican had this kind of advanced technology where they could look into the past or look into the future. And if you're doing counterintelligence, this is an ideal tool. So the Vatican worked very closely with the CIA, and this technology, even today, is still used. And this is where we get this kind of mysterious post by Q referring to Project Looking Glass.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the Vatican has two telescope observatories? I mean, I've always found that to be weird, Michael.
Yes, well, the Vatican has those observatories there in Arizona. One there and also in the Vatican or in Rome itself, they have telescopes. And they are very interested in some of the ancient legends because the Vatican has a vast library. They have the records from extinct or civilizations that have long since collapsed, but they have all of the records, the Library of Alexandria, the records of Atlantis, even going further back to places like Lemuria, Hyperborea. The records of these ancient civilizations and the legends, these are things that are possessed by the Vatican, as well as the artifacts. So the Vatican has a lot of this ancient information, a lot of artifacts, and so they're very interested in the stories about extraterrestrial visitors and these periodic incursions of extraterrestrials into our region of space, and how you would actually have these cataclysmic turn of events at the end of every cycle. So the Vatican has been very interested in that. And so because we are approaching the end of a cycle, the Vatican observatories, I think that, you know, one of their major functions is to look for telltale signs that we are about to experience a sudden shift, a major cataclysmic set of events that could be earth changes, that could be some kind of ascension event, something fundamentally transformative for our world.
Can't let a night go by without you talking about Alex Collier.
Oh, yes. Alex, good friend, known him for many years. He is someone who says that he was in contact with Andromedan extraterrestrials. And he said that the Andromedans, when they established communications with him, he said that they made contact because in the future, 350 years into our future, a global galactic tyranny took hold, and that when they traced the origins of that galactic tyranny, it came back to this time, and they traced it back to the Earth, the Moon, and Mars. These three planetary objects are in some way connected with the genesis of a galactic tyranny that spreads out throughout our galaxy. And so the Andromedans came back in time to basically change that. And one of Alex's jobs was to basically reveal what was happening on planet Earth in terms of these negative extraterrestrials infiltrating and taking over a lot of our institutions.
You talk about a tie-in with the late Art Bell and Andrew Basiago, of course, who has claimed that he was involved in a project, of course, that beamed him to Mars.
That's right, yes. Andy says he's been involved in two sets of projects. One, the jump gate, the Mars jump gate, where basically people were sent to Mars. But there was an earlier project called Project Pegasus. And he says that Project Pegasus, that ran from around 1968 to around 1972, kind of overlapping with the Montauk Project, and basically doing the same thing that was happening at the Montauk Project, which was they were using children to test these technologies. But whereas in the Montauk Project, they were taking kids off the street, you know, children regarded as expendable, whose loss wouldn't be kind of missed too much. With the Project Pegasus, they were using kids from elite families, military families, and so forth. So
these voluntarily were, or snatching them?
Oh, these children were volunteered. So,
they were, okay, so by their parents, I guess.
That's right, yeah. So Andy's father actually worked with the Ralph M. Parsons Company, and they were the primary contractor for building this time travel technology for the CIA and DARPA, the predecessor to DARPA, which at that time was called ARPA. So Andy Basiago was one of the children that was volunteered into these, and he went through these projects, into that project, and he was involved in these time travel experiments. But he says that I believe it was 1970 or 71, He went to an AT&T facility. That's a major company that had a outlet there in Nutley, New Jersey, and he says that he actually met Art Bell at that facility in 1971.
Really? Jeez.
Right. He says he met Art Bell at that facility, that he was part of this group of children that went through the facility and saw Art Bell. So he said this in an interview with Art Bell, and you know, I and many others heard Art's reaction, and he was completely shocked because he said that he hasn't told anyone about that he had worked at that IT&T facility at Nutley.
Did Art admit it?
Yes, he admitted it on air that he did work at that facility and that he was working on highly classified NATO projects. And he didn't say anything more about the project.
How would Basiago know about it unless he was there?
Exactly. No one knew about that because I think that's Art has been very careful in revealing anything about his classified work for the military or with contractors. But Basiago was there, and Art was shocked. And that when I heard that and heard the shock in Art's voice, I realized that Andy was there, that he was part of a highly classified program. Because you don't get access, you know, if you're a child, you don't just go to a highly classified facility doing NATO top secret projects as a child. I mean, you have access because you're working in a project.
Right.
So that substantiated what Andy was saying.
That's amazing. Tell us what you think, what you really think, Michael, is going on at the South Pole, Antarctica.
Well, and Antarctica, I think what's been going on there is that there have been projects that were set up in the 1940s by a breakaway group of Germans that were able to escape Nazi Germany before its collapse, setting up highly advanced technologies in bases that they had been helped to find down there under the ice, using their submarines with at the time kind of state-of-the-art snorkel equipment, so that they could go deep under the water for prolonged periods of time. They were able to navigate under the ice sheets into these ancient riverbeds and deep into Antarctica, where they built these bases. And after establishing themselves in those bases and building very powerful aerospace vehicles, including flying saucers, they were able to reach agreements with the U.S. military industrial complex. This is especially after the 1947 Operation High Jump incidents, where Admiral Byrd admitted that the naval task force that he was in charge of suffered significant casualties in Antarctica, that the Germans and the Americans reached agreements and then began collaborating. And so the Americans began to send a lot of equipment, a lot of resources to the Germans in Antarctica. And in exchange, the Germans helped the Americans set up their space program. And so you...
Wow.
That's right. And you had the Apollo program being set up, and the Germans that was basically running the Apollo program, we're talking about Wernher von Braun in charge of the Marshall Space Flight Center, and Kurt DeBus, who was in charge of the Kennedy Space Center. They were running the Apollo program, but it was a cover. It was a cover for huge amounts of money to be sent down to Germany, money and resources to be sent down to Germany, and in exchange, the Germans were helping the Americans with their reverse engineering of flying saucer technologies. So Apollo program was a cover, and I say in the Air Force book that basically Apollo got Americans to the moon, but it got the Germans to Mars and Alpha Centauri.
Michael, of everything you've investigated over the years since you've been doing exopolitics, what's the one thing that has just boggled your mind?
Well, the agreements that were reached. I always found these diplomatic agreements that were reached between the Eisenhower administration
And the ETs?
Extraterrestrials at places like Edwards Air Force Base and Holloman Air Force Base. Those were things that really blew my mind because I actually was working in international diplomacy. That was one of the things I was doing at American University and teaching courses in international diplomacy and doing it myself. I'd done diplomacy in East Timor and Kosovo and Sri Lanka. So that was a field that I was very interested in. And so the thought that we were galactic diplomacy was being conducted secretly, that just blew my mind.
That is dramatic. Michael Sala's website, exopolitics.org, a couple of his books, U.S. Air Force Secret Space Program, Kennedy's Last Stand. Do you think we have that secret space program up and running?
Definitely, yes. It is. It's been up and running, as best as I can tell, since the 1970s. There have been different craft that have been developed. The Air Force has its own fleets of flying saucer technologies and flying triangle technologies and even rectangle-shaped technologies. And the Navy has its own secret space program where they have these battle groups that operate in deep space. Kind of similar to an aircraft carrier battle group in the oceans around the world. The Navy does the same thing in terms of deep space. So both the Navy and the Air Force have their own separate space programs. And as far as I'm aware of, the Air Force program has been largely sequestered or separated from the Navy program.
David Politis was our guest a couple hours ago talking about extraterrestrials and UFOs. Michael, I want to talk with you about that when we come back, and we'll take phone calls in our next hour on Coast to Coast AM.